welcome to Sip for Speaks, the podcast for public finance professionals. My name is Ursula and I'll be hosting today's episode. To celebrate Women's History Month, we're hosting a special episode of Sip for Speaks and have only invited women to speak on the show. I will be speaking to our first guest, Erica Roscoe, who is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Public Policy Research, specifically working with IPPR North. She has a background in local government policy, and today we will be exploring her career so far, the challenges involved in levelling up the north of the UK, and how regional divides may worsen existing inequalities, especially for women. This episode's other guests will be interviewed by my colleague Vivian. Our second speaker is Professor Diane Coyle, who currently holds the position of Bennett Professor of Public Policy at the Bennett Institute of the University of Cambridge. Diane will be speaking about her work in exploring a new economics framework fit for the digital age. She will also be discussing what else needs to be done to empower young women who are just starting their careers, and how the world of economics still has much to do for gender equality. Our third and final guests are Jess Bowie and Susanna Brecknell, both of whom work as editor of Civil Service World in a job share. They will be discussing the challenges and benefits of working in a high-profile job share while also being a mother. They will also share their insights into the heavily male-dominated world of Whitehall and what it really means to be a woman working in such an environment. Coming up next is today's first guest, Erica Roscoe.
Thank you so much, Erica, for being on the show today. I'd just like to start off with asking, you have a background in local government policymaking. Could you start by telling us a little bit about your research and your career so far?
Sure, thanks for having me. So I've always worked in research and I started my career working in research in the cultural sector actually. So not exactly sort of in line with local government, but first of all, I worked in a private consultancy and then worked at the British Council. So whilst I was at the British Council, I was still working in arts and cultural research, but looking a little bit more at sort of the impact of that on society and those kind of links there. In around 2018, I moved to Manchester City Council where I worked in research and policy, and this experience gave me a real insight into understanding how research and evaluation was used to inform decision making at that local government level. So whilst I was at the council, I worked on areas including things like early years, early help, and then during the pandemic, I also worked on some emergency food support work, working to make sure that people who couldn't get out to the shops right at the beginning of the pandemic in particular still managed to get the support that they needed. That all gave me an awful lot of insight into the functions of local government and the need to sort of have that research and evidence to underpin decision making and that kind of thing.
That's really interesting to hear. So I'm just wondering, from there, how did you get involved with IPPR, especially the recently published State of the North, Powering Northern Excellence report? And kind of going on from that, what were the goals for this report initially?
So I started working at IPPR North in March 2021, so I've just been there just about a year now. And with my background in early years and early help, that meant that I had some experience of how support offered by local government links to education and health. And when I say early years and early help, what I mean is looking at sort of early years provision, so for children aged 0 to 5, and the provision and support that's offered, you know, at that level. And then with regards to early help, that's a program of support offered to people who perhaps are struggling with things, not quite at the point of crisis, hopefully, you know, but hopefully with a bit of support, they can kind of get back on track with things. So it's supposed to be a much more holistic offer, just providing more general support to people rather than kind of super targeted like other services might do. So with my experience of working in those areas, I had some understanding of how sort of that support offered at a local level by local government, links through to education and to health services. And with the State of the North report this year, I mean, every year the State of the North report is a collaborative effort, the whole team's involved. And this year we wanted to assess how the government was doing against its levelling up commitments. So we wrote and released the report before the white paper was released. So we obviously had expectations about what the levelling up white paper would include, but we didn't know for certain what would be in there or indeed when it would be released. So we chose to focus on the economy, net zero and education, because these were three areas that we felt were key to the levelling up agenda. With, as I mentioned, sort of my background, I focused on some of the education and skills work in the report. We know that there are disparities in attainment across the country. But what I wanted to understand was trying to gauge a little bit more about how things had changed following the pandemic, when we knew that there'd been high rates of school absences and things like that across the north. So the goals were to really try and understand how things were going against the existing levelling up commitments, and particularly to look at those three areas: economy, net zero, and education. The title of the report, Powering Northern Excellence, something we were really keen to do with the report was to highlight where there were examples of excellence and of people levelling up for themselves. So we made sure to include a number of different case studies and examples in that, from things like regional and local government initiatives, right down to those sort of small grassroots community organisations who were doing things at that very local level, but making a huge difference to communities.
Great, thank you. And it's really interesting to hear you draw on the work that's relevant to communities and individuals rather than just as national policy, as I think that's a very important part of levelling up that's maybe sometimes overlooked. The State of the North report examines differences between promises and reality for levelling up and the need to further empower communities and individuals, as you said, across the north of England. What would you highlight as the key findings from this research, and what recommendations would you have for central government policy going forward, considering the recommendations of the report?
Yeah, so the key findings from the report were that despite the rhetoric around levelling up, the reality is actually quite different, and the UK is more regionally divided than ever. We also found that when we looked at the levelling up commitments against reality, we found that there were instances where the government was actually seeming to undermine their own agenda, and that promises were being broken, delayed or scaled back, or represented reductions in funds that they were supposed to replace. And actually, there was, in line with this increased regional division, things were becoming more centralised. So an example of that is with public spending. 4 years ago, for every £1 of tax, 95 pence of that went to Whitehall. And just for some context here, in Germany, that figure at the time was 65 pence. Today, despite all of the discussion around levelling up and that whole rhetoric and narrative, the amount per pound in tax that now goes to Whitehall is actually increased to 96 pence. So we are seeing increased regional divisions and increased centralisation. And we've seen that across a range of different areas, with things like job creation. For every one job created in the north, just under three are created in London and the greater southeast. And we're also seeing things like, as I mentioned, the real consequences that this has for people. We're seeing things like in-work poverty increase. So in 2009-10, 3.4 million people were in work poverty across the north. This has actually increased to 3.5 million people in 2019-20. So those were some of the findings of the report. You know, really big challenges still ahead for that levelling up agenda. But we also found that there was some excellent work being done at that local level. People on the ground, whether it's in local government, in regional government, or in those communities, like I talked about, they know what needs to be done to level up, and they're getting on with the job, and they're taking the initiative and doing it for themselves. But it's not fair to rely on those people alone to level up the country. And, you know, it brings with it a number of risks where places and people get left behind. So what we need for the government to meet them in the middle and to be working to ensure that that levelling up is happening across the country. And in terms of the recommendations of the report, we highlighted recommendations across those three areas of economy, net zero and education. And we made recommendations that could be made at a number of different levels, highlighting, you know, what's needed from national government, but also what could be done at that more regional and local level as well, drawing on some of those examples that we'd seen of great practice and great work happening across the north. But what we'd really recommend as the key linchpin to levelling up is enhanced devolution and giving local leaders the powers to level up for themselves. Not just the powers, but the resources as well. So they need the funding as well as the responsibility. And with this, we think that there needs to be a reset in that local and national government relationship. So it needs to be a more collaborative approach taken, and a more collaborative relationship between local and national government in order to really make progress and move forward with levelling up.
Great, thank you. And drawing on from this need to reset, the relationship between national and local government. I guess the report outlines some of the inequalities which would be experienced by people living in the north, and the ways in which the government has failed to deliver certain promises or replace funding, as you said, and left certain parts of the country behind. For demographics, especially women who might already be experiencing social or economic injustice, how do you think these regional divides might intensify inequality? And do you think the current national approach is doing enough to address these additional imbalances?
So I think on that question, I'd draw you to our Women in the North report, which was released around this time last year, actually, to coincide with International Women's Day then. And that does a great job of highlighting the impact of some of these intersecting inequalities. That report looked at different inequalities and how they overlapped to have a disproportionate impact on people who were in certain groups, particularly looking at the challenges faced by women living across the north of England. And we did some similar research into disabilities, which also highlighted a similar finding, and that those people who were living in the north were more disproportionately impacted by inequalities. And you asked about the current national approach and whether it's doing enough to address these imbalances. No, currently it's not, because the solution is to adopt more inclusive policymaking and to make sure that people who are at the sharp end of these inequalities are put front and centre of policymaking going forward.
Thank you. There are some really great insights there that I think our listeners will be interested in, especially that last question when you talk about intersectional policymaking. I think is really, really relevant for International Women's Day, Women's History Month, and kind of the increased focus on intersectionality that I think has been prominent in this field of discourse in the last few years. Leading on from your last point on intersectional policymaking and putting these demographics at the centre of future approaches, can you think of any role models in the sector you'd like to highlight or shout out on today's episode?
Yeah, so I think what we've seen, particularly over the last couple of weeks with International Women's Day, is we've seen some great examples of women who are working in this area, particularly on Twitter. And I think that they don't always get the recognition that they so rightly deserve, working in local government, in local policymaking and that kind of thing. And the NHSA did a great thread for International Women's Day called, with the hashtag for North Innovation Women. And it was great to be included in that list. That's awesome. Alongside all of my brilliant colleagues at IPPR North, including our current director, Ariana. And it's really great to see female leadership. But it's also really good to see these kinds of campaigns, because it highlights the sheer number of women working in this area who are doing really great work, you know, very often, frustratingly, still not getting some of the recognition that they deserve. So it's great to see campaigns like that, which really highlight such a range, a broad range of women working in this area.
Thank you for that. I completely agree. And I hope that this International Women's Day marks maybe a step forward for some more progress, some more visibility for the women working in this sector who deserve recognition. Thank you so much for being on the show, Erica.
Thanks very much.
Our second guests today are Jess Bowie and Susanna Brecknell, who will be talking with my colleague Vivian.
Jess Bowie, Susanna Brecknell, welcome to the Sit for Speaks podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. Would you each like to introduce yourselves to our listeners, say a little bit about who you are, what you do, and then maybe a little bit about the civil service world and what its remits is and who its readers are? Jess, do you want to go first?
Sure. So I am Jess Bowie. I'm editor of Civil Service World, or co-editor with Susanna Brecknell, and I have worked at CSW's parent company, Dodds, for coming up to 10 years now. And I started on the political side of things. So I started on the House magazine and the now defunct Total Politics before moving across to become editor of CSW in late 2014. And that was quite a steep learning curve, because I had covered politics before, but I had never covered government.
So I'm Susanna Brecknell. I am also editor of Civil Service World, and I have been at Civil Service World. I'm a civil service junkie. I never bothered with the political side of our company. I've been at Civil Service World for 12 years, and we've been job sharing since 2018. So we work together. Civil Service World is the independent professional publication for the senior civil service. Our remit is really to cover how government works, to support civil servants understanding what they need to know about policy, government, internal policies within the civil service, to help them in their working lives. And we have a magazine that goes out monthly to the SCS, and we also have a website which has a kind of slightly broader remit looking at the whole of the civil service, so all the grades and all the issues that would be of importance to them in their working lives.
How do you find that as a kind of beat to cover? Is that, you said you're a civil service junkie, is that something that fascinates and excites you? And I'm interested, is it a different beast from political journalism and the lobby? Susanna, what are your reflections on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason I just said there is that distinction between politics and government, and one of the reasons I love writing about the civil service is that we write about government and policy and so many interesting things without any of the politics. So both from the perspective of we are explicitly not supposed to have any political angle ourselves, we're impartial like our readers, so there's no pressure from our publishers or anything to follow a particular angle, but also from the perspective of I actually find a lot of politics quite tedious, you know, the kind of who's in, who's out and political games, you know, it's fun and the gossip is, you know, it's interesting for a while, but I'm glad I don't have to follow that and report on that, and that our job is more about getting under the skin of what is a policy about.
And Jess, you have got a background in political journalism, I think you said it.
Yeah, for a while. And I mean, I think when I first, I'm about to say something that's going to sound very negative about my current beat, but it's not supposed to be. But you know that old adage that politicians campaign in poetry and they govern in prose? And so covering politics, you know, all these sort of grand manifesto promises, and then when you move over to covering the sort of grinding in what it takes to actually implement those policies, that's the kind of prose bit. And so I think that's why there are far fewer Whitehall nerds than there are Westminster nerds. But I was actually quite relieved to get away from all the mudslinging and the, as Sue says, who's up, who's down, that kind of stuff. It is fun, but actually, this is the real business of running the country and tackling wicked problems. I've become fascinated in what the civil service does. It does so many more things than I knew it ever did. I mean, one of my favourite interviews was with the chief vet. I didn't realise Britain had a chief vet. So something that I have found unexpectedly fulfilling about this beat is being able to give civil servants a voice when they don't really have one elsewhere. I mean, they have their trade unions, but they can't really defend themselves when they're attacked. It's nice for us to be able to stand up for them when they can't do that themselves. And so that's what gets, we're not political, but we can come as close as we get to being political is to pushing back on specific ministers when they are dragging our readers through the mud.
Really interesting that you've said that, you know, you're non-political, and of course civil servants can't be political. Does that make it quite difficult to do that job as a journalist? Is it quite difficult to get people to go on the record, get quotes and to find stories?
Yes, that is difficult. And I think civil servants are so used to being trashed and all the negative stereotypes around them, you know, that they're sort of pen pushers or fat cat bureaucrats with gold-plated pensions wasting taxpayers' money. So I think even though we are called Civil Service World and we pitch ourselves as a critical friend to the civil service, and I would say we are more of a friend than a critic, but we, you know, we like to have deeper conversations. But it does make people very jumpy and nervous, and suddenly calling off interviews or telling, actually, you know, that's not going to be on the record. Whereas I find MPs, they are a lot more media hungry. They're very happy to be texted, WhatsApped.
I think the other thing that is hard, as you sort of say, in having that deeper conversation is being able to phrase your questions when we're talking about really interesting things that government is doing. We want to kind of get under the skin of what's happening. We want to understand what are the challenges, you know, maybe what went wrong in a previous iteration and what can be learnt. They're very wary about anything that could be seen as talking negatively, even if we want to talk about actually how did you overcome that challenge. But also it's hard as a journalist sometimes to phrase the questions correctly, because you can't go to a civil servant and ask them, why is this policy so bad? You have to ask them around implementation and the delivery and the process of advice. Yet you have to try and find an interesting way into relevant issues. So, you know, how do you ask the communities department about Grenfell, you know, or how do you ask a Home Office around about Windrush in the fallout from those situations when they're A, defensive, and B, you're trying to get into like the truth of the situation rather than politics of the situation? And how do you present an article which is fair and useful and interesting to our readers, but also not going to add to the trouble of the people you've spoken to. So one thing we're really wary of is not kind of setting our people we interview up for a fall. Civil Service World has more presence now, more people are more aware of us in other parts of the media. So therefore, we get more pickup on some of our stories, which is good, but also it makes our readers more wary if they're speaking to us and they're conscious that we might be friendly, but the rest of the world is not so friendly.
We're recording this podcast for International Women's Day, and we're only platforming women's voices on this podcast. What's your assessment of Whitehall as a place for women to work? I think when you think of the typical civil servant, you often probably think of a man in a bowler hat with a rolled umbrella. Are we in a different place now?
Yeah, I would say we are. I mean, I'm so very immersed in this world now that I haven't actually had time to ask the woman on the street or the man on the street what they, when they picture a civil servant, what they think of. But it's very interesting, actually, in the last 10 years, I have seen a real shift in the conversations that we've been having. They've moved on. And I'm not saying everything's, you know, hunky-dory. Women every day are overlooked and mansplained and things like that. But it's definitely improved over time. The emphasis now is shifting to other forms of diversity and inclusion more widely. You know, there are conversations about neurodiversity, about disabled inclusion, about trans rights. And so I think there's always work to be done, but it's definitely improved.
Yeah, and I think if I step back even the wider picture a bit, the kind of the bigger arc from 2011 onwards, so I guess the reason for that soul searching in 2014-15 was that we had up until that point had a kind of almost seemed inexorable progress of more women in the SCS. And there was this, you know, high point in 2011 where we had 50-50 perm sex, but it lasted about 10 days. And then one of the female perm sex resigned. And then after that, because it's quite a small group, you know, a man was appointed here, a woman resigned there, it started going down. And so there was this soul searching around 14-15 about, oh, have we hit a problem here that's a long-term problem? But as Jess said, the arc has kind of kept going in the right direction. There's now 46.7% women in the SCS, which is, I think, about 10-11% more than when I started writing. So it has gone up. And it's fair to say, I think, that civil service is a good employer for women in terms of flexibility, support for those with caring responsibilities, you know, option for career breaks, that sort of thing. But I would caveat that by saying it's a good place if you're a white middle or upper class woman, and the picture is quite different if you're a working class woman, black woman, Asian woman. Picture in those groups is much less positive in the SCS particularly. So it's actually just 6.9% of the SCS are from an ethnic minority background and just 18% from disadvantaged backgrounds. So it's obviously an awful lot less. And I think from contacts we've spoken to, research we've been doing, that's a lot about how recruitment and promotion happens in the SCS. So at the lower levels, there's been a lot of work done on blind recruitment, on, you know, really working hard to get truly open recruitment processes. And that's harder to do in the SCS. It's a smaller group, too often still really about kind of who you know, who your sponsor is, and appointments are made on temporary promotion, which doesn't require you to have a open recruitment. It's just an expression of interest is required. So it's easier to therefore kind of, you know, tap someone on the shoulder and say, can you come into this post? And therefore they then get that made permanent in due course, which, you know, there's reasons for doing that. If you need to fill a post quickly, the recruitment process can take a while, but that obviously perpetuates a situation where people are choosing, tapping on the shoulder, people who look like them. And that might be someone of a different gender, but it's still someone of the same background and mindset. And as Jess says, you know, same kind of neuro background to them. So I think there's been good progress. And I definitely, as with Jess, don't recognise the sense of civil service as kind of all middle-aged, middle-class men with bowler hats. But it is far from being, you know, a perfect place for women or people of different backgrounds.
We still never had a female cabinet secretary. Yeah, is that glass ceiling there, or is that the wrong metric? That is just one post in among many. So should we be looking at a different metric?
I actually think we could have had a female cabinet secretary this time. There was a lot of speculation about whether Antonia Romeo would step in if Simon Case did not survive Partygate. And the Prime Minister has just appointed his permanent secretary of number 10 as a woman. The pipeline is there. I think that there are a good handful. I mean, there are actually very few people in the seat because it is the most senior post. There aren't actually that many people who could step into it. So it's quite a small pool. But in that pool, I think the pipeline is there. And as to whether having a female cabinet secretary would change the dynamic at the top, the jury's out, because I think that stereotype of female leaders being more collaborative and touchy-feely is going slightly out of fashion. They can be just as ruthless as men, and men can be just as touchy-feely, not literally, one hopes, but you know, they can espouse open leadership.
Yeah, I would say that. So to your question, Viv, around is it the right metric? I think there is a challenge in that Jess and I both hate this term, but she is right. There is the pipeline is building up, and particularly kind of there are permsecs who would be capable, but also there is a pool of DGs, and particularly at the, which is the level below permsecs for people who are not au fait with civil service grades. You know, there are women there and coming up who could do the job, but the way in which the cabinet secretary is chosen is so personal to the prime minister and the circumstances in which that appointment is made. So in 2016, it was the centenary anniversary of the cabinet office being created, and there was lots of events where the, you know, living cabinet secretaries all got together and spoke about being a cabinet secretary. And invariably, someone would say, "You're all men. When is there going to be a female cabinet secretary?" And I remember Jeremy Hayward saying that he thought not his successor, but his successor's successor would be a woman. We've had two cabinet secretaries since then, but they were both appointed in such unusual and difficult circumstances that you can kind of, you know, you can't say, well, that's because it was sexism that meant that there was not a woman chosen two times after Jeremy Hayward. It's such a unique position.
Theresa May chose Mark Sedwill because he was a known quantity. Yeah. She'd worked with him at the Home Office. You know, there are other factors.
I suppose the civil service, it feels quite, for an outsider like me, it looks quite hierarchical. And could you not argue it's a system designed and created by men, and we're expecting women to slot into that system? Should we not be asking, can women remake that system into something a bit different?
Yeah, and I think that kind of comes to the point around, I mean, this is a debate in kind of when you're talking about gender equality and feminism more broadly. But it's that question around, are the women who are making it to the top of this system actually just replicas of the men in terms of the way they think, the backgrounds they have, the careers they have taken? So, again, to kind of come back a little bit to Jess's question around, would a woman in at the cabinet secretary level or in senior level change the system? Well, not if she had the same background as the man in the post before her. And, you know, there are women in top of senior civil service now with a different range of backgrounds. So Sarah Munby, who's head of the business department now, has come from business quite recently, or Bernadette Kelly comes from a more disadvantaged background. She's spoken to us about feeling the need to soften her Brummie accent when she joined the civil service, and she's the social mobility, one of the social mobility champions in the civil service now. So there are people coming up who are from different backgrounds, and I don't think necessarily it's a hierarchical question. I think a hierarchical organization can still be, you know, a diverse one, but there definitely is a question around the culture in the civil service and around what is defined as a good leadership quality and what is defined as how they find intelligent people. So I think often Oxbridge is used as a shorthand for, we just want someone who can think logically and analyze and help give advice. And we know that we went to Oxbridge and we can do that. So we just look for someone who is like us. And, you know, maybe a male leader thinks, I want someone who can push through change. And I think that that has to be done by someone who's confident and who is outgoing. And I see that quality in myself. I see it in my male deputy. So, yeah, I think it's a fair point that there could be system change to help women and other people who don't fit the current leadership mould to progress further in the civil service. I think it's something that a lot of walks of life are dealing with.
Just moving on to the final part of the interview now, the topic about journalism, which I think, it, like the civil service, can be perceived as quite macho, quite competitive, quite boysy, although there's loads of fantastic female journalists and editors. How have you each found making your career in journalism as a woman?
I've not been kind of treated differently or experienced sexism from other journalists, particularly in my career. Where I have encountered difficulties, it's really been from kind of either contacts or colleagues, and mostly people from a different generation. So, you know, I had one older kind of someone who was writing for us and who watched me attending an event and then messaged me afterwards to say that it was unbecoming of me to interrupt a fellow panelist, and would I like him to give me some sort of coaching and mentoring and improving my confidence. And so it's that kind of thing that I've encountered, but not from journalists. I think I've been quite lucky because most of my career has been in trade journalism, public service journalism, and working for companies where there was either like a female leader, strong female leadership, or there was sexism around in the company, but I was kind of left to my own devices and insulated from it.
I could echo what Sue said about not necessarily receiving it on the receiving end of sexism from my direct peers. But when I was a younger Westminster journalist, a lot of that is about trying to get gossip, contacts and insider info. And one of my contacts, who was just the most amazingly garrulous gossipy guy of a certain vintage, I might add, you know, there was a lot of what he said would make me just squirm in my seat because it was so sexist in a sort of old boys club. But he would talk about Liz Truss as the Trussette. He would often comment on my appearance, and so we would meet for coffees, and I'd come away feeling, I mean, this is nothing compared to what some female journalists, you know, hands on knees and all that kind of, and worse. But, you know, it was that odd power dynamic of being a young woman, and this male MP knows that they are useful to you, and so they don't mind about making you feel uncomfortable. I had that quite a lot. I feel fortunate in my professional life that I have not been subject to horrendous sexism.
You are collectively the editor of Civil Service World. It's a really fascinating working arrangement. How do you make that work? And would you advocate a job share as a way forward for other women?
I think we both would. And so the nuts and bolts for us are that we work 3 days a week each, and we cross over on Tuesday, which is the day we traditionally send the magazine to print. And we have a kind of hybrid model. So there are some bits of our job that we split 50-50 and we pass baton between us. For example, the magazine, you know, we work together collectively on planning and filling the pages on each month's magazine. And there are other parts of the job that we own individually. So where we've got like an event or webinar, the person who is in on the day of that event will be chairing it, and therefore that person is working on that project. So it has really worked well for us. And I think part of the reason for that is that we've been able to basically make it work for us. We've just made up a structure and a system that suits us. And obviously, underpinning that, we have a good relationship and a lot of respect for each other. And we had worked together separately before we became a job share. But we are the only job share in our company. And although we've tried to kind of learn from good practice, and we commissioned a lot of articles from job sharing civil servants when we began job sharing to learn their wisdom.
Actually, I hadn't heard of the concept of doing a job share until I started covering Whitehall and the civil service. And so we were inspired by a lot of the very successful job shares in the civil service. I think so much of it depends on personality, you know, getting on. We get on really well. We are completely in tune with each other's home lives. Sort of, we know what's going on. We have kids sort of roughly the same age. I was literally in a ball pit yesterday in a soft play and managed to have a 35-minute conversation with Suze about work. And that was fine. I wanted to do that. And often we will do little bits and bobs of handovers, or we'll WhatsApp each other on the days when we're not in the office, just because there's always things that we forget and that we just need a quick response to. And I don't think either of us minds that.
No, I think that's probably why I would advocate it as a model for people who want flexible working. I would prefer it to straight part-time work. I did 5 years of part-time working before we began our job share. So in different combinations, from, you know, 2.5 days, 4 days, 3 short days. And one thing when you're part time is it's kind of frustrating that you always have to stop things. And you know that while you are away, you know, you're not there to keep a project going, or you're not there to kind of check that something has actually happened. And you end up looking at work on your days off because you've got those in the back of your mind. Whereas with a job share, you know, you can pass things to your job share partner. And as Jess says, we have an understanding about what's the boundaries on when can I be contacted out of work. And we understand what's urgent enough to bother each other with. So it's a much more fulfilling arrangement for me than the years of part-time working. And it's just such a flexible way of setting up a job.
I will always prioritise doing the work at hand, that's whatever it is, sub-editing something, commissioning something. And then it will get to 10 to 5 or 5 o'clock and I have to leave. And I have not prioritised the handover. I have not started the handover. And because I don't see it as part, it's not a kind of visible part of the job, but it is completely necessary. So then I'll often just say to Suze, oh, well, look, just call me. I'll be in the swimming pool changing rooms on Monday morning. But just, I haven't done my handover yet, but just call me and I'll tell you. And that's not good. I need to get... I'm very guilty of... I must improve.
No, I think I would... you find a way to, I was always at the beginning trying to impose a strict template on Jess, like, can you fill in this thing? But that's not, you know, how it works. And it does work much better if we have that flexibility of talking to each other. And there's also the benefit that you have, you know, you have an inbuilt team between the two of us, and we can kind of coach and mentor each other. We can encourage each other to do things that we find scary or to work to our strengths, to deal with our weaknesses. We can run ideas past each other. We can complain about the company to each other. You know, you have in your job share a support system, which I think is beneficial for individuals, but also again for the company, because it enables us to do better overall.
Yeah, no, we complement each other.
Yeah, I would definitely say that Civil Service World is a better magazine, publication, website, because it has both of us as an editor than it would be if it had just one of us as an editor.
That sounds like a very appropriate place to finish. Jess Bowie, Susanna Brecknell, thank you very much for joining us. It's been fascinating listening to your insights on the civil service and the role of women therein.
Thanks, Viv. Thanks for having
us. Thank you very much, Viv.
Final guest for this special episode is Diane Coyle, who will be speaking with my colleague Vivian.
Hi Diane, thanks so much for joining us today on this very special edition of Sit for Speaks. Would you like to briefly introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit about what you do at the Bennett Institute for Public Policy at the University of Cambridge?
Well, thanks very much for the invitation to join you today. And I'm an economist. I am co-director of the Bennett Institute, as you said, at the University of Cambridge, which is a relatively new public policy institute whose remit is to think about the big problems facing the world today, working across different disciplines so that we bring together engineers, political scientists, economists, lawyers, environmentalists, and work together on addressing the questions. So we divide our work into three areas: place, progress, and productivity. They're obviously all linked together, but they give us a way of shaping the work, whether it's looking at levelling up debates in the UK or looking at questions like how should the United Nations define the way that we're going to measure environmental impacts of climate change and loss of biodiversity. And so it's quite a broad canvas, but we have grown over the last 4 years and have a team of brilliant young researchers who are doing really important and interesting work. And as an economist myself, I'm really passionate about this interdisciplinary aspect of it, because none of us is going to solve big challenges just from the one perspective. We need those different perspectives on problems.
Is that quite a new approach? Is that the Bennett Institute's kind of point of difference, do you think, in the policymaking landscape?
It's definitely quite distinctive. I mean, obviously, there are a few other interdisciplinary policy institutes around, but many of the people who look at policy come from a political science tradition or a public administration tradition. And so we're a bit distinctive in that respect. And we also have some kind of signature pieces of work or areas of work that we do. And one of those is this measurement question about going beyond GDP, where we have been kind of pioneering some of the work. Another is bringing together all the different areas of policy that you need to think about in terms of levelling up or geographic inequalities. And that has brought in the economics, obviously, but also questions about governance and political decision making, and questions about social infrastructure, and questions about well-being, and linking all of those together.
So we're recording this podcast to celebrate International Women's Day. We want to raise awareness against bias against women, take action for equality, and to celebrate women's achievements. And you're a great example of a woman who's achieved a lot in your career. You started as an economist at Treasury in 1985, and you've had various economic editorial roles, and you're still a regular commentator on economic issues. You were a member of the National Infrastructure Commission and the Industrial Strategy Council, a former vice chair of the BBC, and professor of economics at the University of Manchester before moving to your current role at the Bennett Institute. A very impressive list of achievements. Can you tell us some of the challenges that you faced in your career and, you know, being a woman in those fields of sort of academia and public policy?
The list of things that you read out hints at one almost opportunity from being a woman, which is that I've changed career an awful lot. And it's always been by accident. I've stumbled into everything by accident. There was nothing planned about it. But because I took career breaks for my two children, there's almost an acceptance that that's something that you can do. And so in a funny way, I think that's been an advantage. On the other hand, I've always worked in quite male-dominated worlds, and economics, the academic economics world, is one of the most male-dominated there is. And I've experienced the frustrations that any woman will recognise in, you know, being spoken over at meetings or saying things that then get attributed to one of the men, or being patronised, and all of these sort of constant niggles, if you like, that we all experience in our careers. But I think there's obviously still a question about pay comparability for many women, even women who are very accomplished. And at that end of the labour market, if you like, I don't think we know as much as we do about general pay disparities between men and women. We all get fed up of these constant microaggressions, these constant mini challenges that you face every day, or experiences that you have every day as a woman in the workplace. And the assumption that if anybody's going to get called about the kid being sent home from school, it's the mother. Or if anybody's still doing the household planning and management, that's the female partner in a mixed couple. We've made a lot of progress, but I'd say there's still an awful long way for us to go. And that's why we've got International Women's Day, of course.
You mentioned the discipline of economics being very male dominated, and that's probably how people tend to conceive it. There are some striking statistics in your book, Cogs and Monsters. Only 20% of academic economists are female. That's a 2016 figure. Perhaps in the corporate world, in the boardroom, things are changing a bit. There are some Fawcett Society figures that show that the number of women in boardroom roles in FTSE 100 companies is up to 39% now, from only 12.5% a decade ago. So interested in your reflections on that, if that chimes with your experience. Are women becoming more fairly represented in the world of professional finance, whether in academia or business or the public sector?
The area where I've seen most progress, I think, in my time is actually the Government Economic Service and women working in government departments or public bodies like the Competition and Markets Authority. And there was a very serious initiative in the Government Economic Service to change the pattern of gender representation through flexible working, through maternity and paternity leave options, and also through leadership with real intent that if women took up the options that have been made available, they wouldn't be held back in their careers. It wouldn't harm their promotion prospects. Because it's one thing to enable flexible working, and then it's another thing to make sure that that doesn't hinder women's progress through the ranks, through the hierarchy. What's encouraging about the GES experience is that it can be done. You know, they've made a real change in the proportion of women in government economics roles. The other thing they've done, which I think is very interesting, is start an apprenticeship programme. And that expands the pool, the pipeline to other types of diversity, because there's been more measurement of the representation of women than people of colour, but also socioeconomic origins. And with economics in particular, it's more and more done by private schools rather than state schools, which tend to do business studies. And the private schools are also well aware that people going into economics need to have good maths A levels. And that's not so widely known in state schools. And so this is another kind of aspect of the narrowness that needs to be tackled. And apprenticeship schemes are obviously a great way to think about doing that, because they bring in people through different kinds of routes, people who've not had straightforward high school experiences. So, you know, the downside is that there's not been as much progress as we might have liked, but the upside is, from the GES experience, is that actually you can change things if you've got the leadership that's committed to change.
Your book, Cogs and Monsters, talks a lot about the rise of digital technology, AI, big data, that kind of thing, and how they're revolutionising economics and what economics tries to measure and understand. Your argument is that the discipline of economics needs to measure growth and progress in new ways, and you talked about that earlier when you were talking about the Venice Institute. Could you just expand on a little bit more for our listeners? Who are the cogs and who are the monsters in the title? Why did you choose that title?
Well, you know, I chose it to be a catchy title, but the cogs are, it's us. It's the way conventional textbook economics thinks about people as individual decision makers who look at all the information available to them, think about their preferences and decide what the best thing to do is, and acting as individuals. It's an individualist kind of subject. And the monsters are the way that the economy is changing because largely of technology that make us more interdependent. Things we do affect other people more than in the past. To give one example, think about personal data. And there are lots of companies collecting personal data about you and using that for marketing analytics. And so any information that they get about you is conveying information about people like you. And any personal information is contextual. It's useful. Personal data is useful to the extent that it gives useful information once you join it up with something else. So if I go shopping, the data is useful to the store because they can figure out what to restock and they can figure out what people like me buy. But it's all, you know, it's in a sense very personal data because it's about my preference for chocolate over apples. There are lots of network effects in the economy, which means that if I'm using social media or search, things I do have an impact on the quality of the service for other people. They gain more benefit the more that I use it. These are called indirect network effects. So there's a lot of interdependence, and this is changing the way that businesses grow and come to dominate markets. There's the phenomenon of winner-take-all markets in digital, whereby one company typically will dominate a market. And so we've got the big tech group who are dominant at the moment in search and social media and Amazon in retail. And we then want to, you know, think about the dynamics of that. They are slow for a long time. They lose money for a long time. And then they reach a tipping point where they become the dominant company. And the question is, the policy question is, can that change? Could somebody else become the new Google or the new Facebook if they had a better technology? And so thinking about these dynamics becomes important. And so the monsters, to get back to the point, refer to those old medieval maps where there are areas where they didn't really know what was going on or what was there, and they labelled them, here be monsters. And excitingly for me, because it's my area of research, there's a lot to be understood about how the digital economy is changing, how markets operate, how consumers benefit or not from it. And we've got all that filling in of the map still to do. There's a lot we don't understand. So the argument in the book is that the textbook model of economics is just so far from what the economy has become that we need to rethink how we are going about doing it, but also teaching.
Could we look at that through a gender lens? I suppose I'm thinking about technology 50, 60, 70 years ago. Helped liberate women in quite interesting ways. Household appliances, contraception. Are we seeing a new wave of technology that might help liberate women further?
It's a really interesting question. My hunch is that it's actually going the other way with this wave of technologies. I mean, who is trying to invent the robot that will do the ironing? We get the images of the Boston Dynamic robots that are scary creatures chasing people through the woods rather than doing domestic tasks the way that the washing machine liberated women. And so at the moment, there seems to me this sort of Silicon Valley bro air to technology. We've got Elon Musk flinging sports cars into orbit and making these, styling the cars in ways that refer, I suppose, to typically male preferences about looking like a sleek sports car, and a real lack of delivery of, you know, the kinds of domestic technology that, as you said, have helped women so much in the past.
As SITFA, we've obviously been thinking a lot about measurement and evaluation. We recently put out a report which we called Investing in Regional Equality, Lessons from Four Cities, and we took case studies from four cities around the world where there's considerable success in reducing inequalities within those countries. And so we looked at, you know, those success factors and what might be applicable here. The report identified the need to move to a sort of new economic model which moves beyond these traditional measures of economic success. So that's where we measure outcomes such as health, access for education, innovation and research, more jobs and opportunity and better well-being. These are all high value outcomes of investment. What are some of the benefits of measuring and identifying these outputs, and indeed the challenges of doing so, and how do we put that into practice?
There's been a real shift over the past 5 or 10 years in what people think is the right way to measure success in the economy, and a real move away from saying growth in GDP or regional gross value added is good enough. And that's partly a better understanding that the distribution of growth in GDP was so uneven, and we've seen for a long time concentration activity in bigger cities and higher incomes there, and skilled people moving there, these agglomeration economies, as they're called in the jargon, and because lost sight of the fact that there were many smaller places where people were leaving and not going to them, and they didn't have good transport connectivity, and the footprint of public services was being reduced through the austerity cuts that we had in the UK. And, you know, I think people just hadn't realised how that was falling in different places, those combination of events. And that realisation has obviously sunk in now. And we've got here the levelling up white paper. But there's also, you know, as your question raises, the issue about what is it that we should be measuring. I think, again, there's this realisation that it's a much wider array of things that matter to people. Personal health and public health always come up as key issues. A sense of people's ability to have agency over their own lives, and that there's some responsiveness from government that's closer to them than the folks in Westminster and Whitehall, that natural environment, clean air, access to green spaces, and the whole suite of things that are sometimes put under the umbrella of well-being. There isn't a complete consensus yet about what the right set of measures is. And we use the wealth economy approach because it actually does tie in with economic theory, and it allows you both to talk the language that the Treasury understands and that economists understand, so you can have that conversation about broadening the approach in the same language. The other reason I like it is that it takes people away from the deficit model. We've had this terrible period, long period of austerity, people thinking we can't do this and that because we don't have the resources. And of course, that's true. But it's also possible to think about what are the assets that we have. And if you're thinking about that wealth economy framework, and you can start to think about, we've got people assets, we've got assets in terms of maybe cultural or heritage sites, or we've got assets in terms of access to green space. And it doesn't solve the problem of not having resources, but it does, I think, help change the mindset. And if you like, give back some of that sense of agency over what kind of place you live in and what opportunities you get from being there.
Early in February, the government finally released its long-awaited, highly anticipated levelling up white paper. What are your reflections on it from both an economist's perspective and a feminist perspective?
It was a game of two halves. So the first half of the white paper I really liked because it was the first time I've seen in a government economic document the sense of the whole system and having to fix lots of things, not just one thing, that all of these issues work together. So clean air and health outcomes and productivity and access to jobs are linked to each other through transport networks and the kinds of places that people live in. And so that, I thought, was a real milestone, and it was a good first half of the white paper. It then became the usual kind of government document that has a list of marvellous things that they've done or they're going to do. And we've just done some analysis on it, looking at whether it's consistent with previous government policies. And when I say previous policies, I mean this government. I mean the Johnson government and its documents last year, the budget, the plan for growth that came out with the budget, and the innovation strategy. And the answer, in short, is that there's no overlap. So it's a classic economic policy problem that things don't get left in place for very long. They're not evaluated. There's no learning from what doesn't work. The government wants to announce something new all the time. So we've got this lack of consistency. And I found that very disappointing. On the feminist angle to it, I don't really think there is one. I didn't do a word search to see whether it mentions gender issues or issues about household burdens or the burden of social care in the household or anything of that kind, which all speak to women's issues. And so I think that's a loud absence. It just didn't factor it in.
What's going on at the Bennett Institute for Public Policy at the moment? Is there any research that you're currently working on that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Well, we're doing lots of work. My colleagues who work on the wealth economy are looking at how to adjust financial market measures for climate risk and biodiversity risk. And the message basically is that financial markets aren't properly pricing in these risks. And when you integrate what's likely to happen to climate and to biodiversity, they ought to be cutting sovereign and corporate credit ratings. So that's a very exciting and impactful area of work. We're doing work on productivity, both at the national level and for our own region in the east of England. And, for example, looking at skills, innovation, and the role that universities can play in their regions to create new companies and skilled jobs, and what are the skill shortages. I'm always doing work on digital measurement questions, and I'm thinking about how we measure the productivity potential of digitalization in construction is one piece of work, but also starting to think about the measurement of computer software, free digital goods. So it's a very wide range, and the common thread is, if we think the aim of policy is to make people's lives better, then we need to have a good understanding of what we mean by better, which people, and how we measure whether or not that's happening.
And just one final question. I just wanted to ask if you had any advice for any women who may be listening to this and who are keen to develop their careers, whether that's in the public sector or economics or finance, and who are looking to make a positive impact on society.
There are all kinds of ways you can have a positive impact on society. And, you know, I think one of the great lessons in my career has been standing up for other women. And, for example, I talked earlier about the experiences we've all had of men talking over you in meetings or attributing things to other men when it was stated by a woman. Call it out. And it's senior women who can do that. It's senior women who can hire other women. If you're interviewing people, the female candidates are more likely to be reserved or shy about telling you how good they are or about asking for things that they want to do. So I think the onus is on women who've reached a senior stage in their career to reflect on all the hurdles that they've experienced and try to bring down the barriers for the people following on behind them. And it will be good for those younger women, also good for your organisation.
Thank you so much for joining us, Diane. It's been great talking to you today and hearing about your work and insights into the challenges and opportunities being a woman in the field of economics and public policy. Thank you again.
Thank you.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for on today's show. Thank you again to all of the amazing women who made this episode happen, and be sure to tune in again in a month's time.